Hi, I'm Daniel Lenzian, host of Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studios. Western New York Soundstage is a podcast that looks to explore Western New York's creative economy through a series of conversations with artists, musicians, producers, directors, and authors from Western New York and beyond. On today's episode, I speak to Christy Bauer. Christy Bauer is a Los Angeles-based writer and performer whose musicals include The Fitzgeralds of St. Paul and Leni Riefenstahl Is Going to Tell You the Truth. Her work has been produced at iconic venues like Joe's Pub and 54 Below, and she received the American Theater Wing's Jonathan Larson Grant in 2022. A graduate of NYU's Musical Theater Writing Program, she co-hosts the podcasts Caroline on the Podcast and Muppeturgy. A special preview production of her musical, The Fitzgeralds of St. Paul, will be presented at Irish Classical Theatre Company November 8th through the 24th, 2024. Tickets are available at irishclassical.com. In this interview, Christy and I speak about the process of writing a new musical, F. Scott Fitzgerald's Buffalo connection, why preview audiences are so important, and what it means to be an old-timey weirdo. I hope you enjoy my interview with Christy. Christy Bauer, thanks so much for chatting with me today. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Excellent. I always like to start off my interviews by asking, is there a story from your youth that connects to your current work as a theater artist?
Oh, wow. That's a big question. I feel like my entire youth led me to becoming a theater artist. I was one of those, you know, elder millennial kids who grew up on the Disney movies. That was sort of my entry point to theater and musical theater specifically. And as I got to about age 11, that's when I actually, my parents got me tickets to see Phantom of the Opera. And that was sort of the thing that got me in the door. My love of storytelling, and particularly musical storytelling, really started with Disney stuff as a kid, I would say.
That's amazing. When did you realize you wanted to write music, book, and lyrics?
this is the thing that I have wanted to do since I was 12 years old.
It's so interesting. Like sometimes theater artists, they want to start off as actors, and that's what I was sort of wondering, asking this question. Was it always being the writer of the totality of a musical, or was there another entry point?
You know, when I first got into theater and discovered theater, I did for a hot second want to be an actor. But it was really in digging into different pieces and learning new scores. I just remember having a lightning bulb moment of, oh, people get to make these things from scratch. And that was thrilling and terrifying and exciting for me as somebody who had, you know, interest in music and in visual things. Like I grew up, you know, like again with the Disney stuff, I grew up at first wanting to be an animator, and then I wanted to be an Imagineer building rides in the Disney parks. And then over time it was like finding writing musicals was like finding the thing that combined all of the things that I wanted to do in one. So there's something about it's very much like puzzle work, and difficult puzzle work, you know, figuring out the ways in which things piece together, and collaborating with other people to figure out, you know, whether something that you actually imagine in your head is going to move the same way in an actual space. That's the other thing that has been really exciting and great about bringing the show to Irish Classical in Buffalo. Is this is the first time that this particular show has been put on its feet. And so I've been working on it for 10 years, but I'm learning brand new things about it as we're discovering how it actually moves in a space, and how it moves in a space as with the particular challenges that the Irish Classical space, being a space in the round, has. So, yeah, that's kind of a sort of answers your question.
It does. I'm also interested to know, like, because I wonder if, you know, life is told in chapters or if life is told in moments, but was there a particular piece that you wrote or something that you completed that felt really successful that said to you, yes, I am a music book and lyricist, or music book writer and lyricist? Like, what was the, was there a moment like that? Was it a slow kind of reveal to you? How did the path emerge?
The path sort of emerged out of necessity for me a little bit. I went through the NYU Graduate Musical Theater Writing Program, which is a two-year MFA program in which you are trained either as a words person who writes book and lyrics or as a composer who writes the music. And while I was there, I was accepted as a words person, and that's how I trained. But while I was there, I was itching to write music, and I had a few small opportunities to do it. And you get paired with a thesis collaborator in your second year, and for your thesis, you write a full-length musical. And I was very proud of the work that my thesis collaborator and I did, but it was one of those things where collaboration is really tricky, and we were just very different people and had very different approaches to things. And the whole time I found myself thinking, but I would do this. And, and less out of ego, more just out of like, I'm like, but I want to get in there and I want to get my hands even messier, you know? And so, while I was working on my thesis project, it was like, I would like work on a piece of it and send it to my collaborator. And while he was working, I was working on a totally different piece of my own. I just kept writing things that I felt like I had a clear vision for, because the collaborations that have been most useful to me have been with directors, have been with designers, have been with arrangers and orchestrators and actors. And, you know, like there are multiple ways around a thing, but like the things that I have written that have been just me are things where I have to get the idea on paper for people to understand it. Sometimes you've just got that thing where you're like, I understand what this is. In talking about it, I can't necessarily get you to understand it, but let me just take a crack at throwing it out there and then see if there's something that speaks to somebody other than me.
I love that. And it kind of leads into the way that you self-identify on your website, which is a fearless storyteller and an old-timey weirdo. I love that you kind of put that on your website. What inspired you to have people meet you in this way?
I think of myself, the word that I've started using, because old-timey weirdo is not a thing that necessarily translates to people all the time. I think of myself as a synthesist. I like to take things that I've found, influences from history and pop culture, and, you know, just things that are exciting and meaningful to me, and throw them together and see what happens. One of the reasons that I was excited to write a piece about the Fitzgeralds is I had always wanted to write songs in the song styles of the 20s and 30s and 40s. So when this idea came to me, I was like, finally I have a thing where, you know, the content dictates the form, and I can do this, and it makes sense. It is part of the fabric of their world. I can explore that. Like I really find that kind of historical excavation satisfying and interesting. I digging into the texture of other times to me feels like exploring, you know, like new planets. And so that's kind of where that comes from. Is I grew up on Nick at Night and old TV, and listening to old music, and I was an oldies station kid, so like all of those things sort of have informed the way I approach telling stories, which I think helps. Like, I think people run into the danger of it in trying to tell stories that speak to contemporary audiences, in trying to do the thing that is most at the forefront of technology or the most at the forefront of style and form. And for me, I find that you stumble upon those things by accident. And the way that I look for them is in interrogating the past.
Interview over. No, I'm kidding, but that was a beautiful answer. Like, that was amazing. And I couldn't agree more, right? That sometimes, or trying to be on the vanguard of things change so quickly that we're unable to kind of even see what we're writing about because there's sort of a new advancement or a new technology or a new something that completely shifts. I want to go back to what you were saying in terms of a synthesis. Did I say that correctly? Synthesis?
Yeah.
And I love that. I think that's wonderful. It seems like you're synthesizing on your two podcasts, Caroline and the Podcast and Muppeturgy. These are two pieces of pop culture, Caroline and the City and the Muppets. How do they inspire or inform your work? And what have you learned from your deep dive with Caroline and the City and the Muppets?
So what's funny is both of those podcasts started as pandemic projects, and one of them is more active at the moment than the other. The Caroline and the City podcast, we are going to get back to, but it's that thing. If we had a lot of time to edit and do all of the admin work, podcasts are a lot of admin work, as I am sure you know. But with both the Caroline podcast and with Muppeturgy, there's been a real joy in digging into examining story and character. And you know, my role on Muppeturgy is, so what we do is we examine every episode of the Muppet Show from multiple angles. We look into what was in the news the week that the episode aired, you know, what was on TV that same night, what was playing in the New York theater that night. What I do, one of the things that I bring to it is I do research on the music. And so I have learned so much about so many different types of music, because they did a lot of songs from like the Victorian Music Hall, for example. So now I've learned about all of these wild characters from the Victorian Music Hall as a consequence of looking up these obscure public domain songs that the Muppets did. And so I find curiosity to be like my driving motor in everything that I do. I think having an open mind and an open heart can take you anywhere. And so that's been particularly with the Muppet Show, but also with the Caroline and the City podcast, because we, you know, over the course of starting it, we were able to talk to some of the people who'd been involved with the show and learn a bit about like the, you know, the machinery of, you know, must-see TV sitcom and all of the, you know, cooks that were in the kitchen and how frustrating it was for, as a writer. We talked to one of the writers and she told us about how frustrating it was to be a female writer in a male dominated field, and how she would say things like, oh, you know, these female characters would be wearing sweatpants to brunch. And, you know, the network executives were like, no, but the audiences want to see Leah Thompson in a miniskirt, you know, like things like that. So, you know, just getting to learn about, you know, the people that make the things and to just dig into, because I think at the end of the day, any piece of art that gets made is a miracle, you know, like it takes so much time and so much effort and so many resources for anything to get made, especially on the level of a network TV show. And so getting to really like do a deep dive into those worlds has been fascinating.
You mentioned women writers, and you are a proud member of ASCAP, the Dramatists Guild, and Maestra. Can you tell us a little bit about the importance of Maestra?
Absolutely. So Maestra is an incredible organization that was founded by the writer Georgia Stitt that advocates for female identifying and non-binary writers and musicians in the theater. And part of their initiative, it originally started just as sort of like a, you know, networking, you know, putting us all in the same room so that we could talk about our experiences. But over time, they've built a directory that is now international, has thousands of members, because part of the problem in the lack of parity with women writers and musicians in the theater is just at a certain point, you hire the people you know, and you hire the people that you've seen. And so there was a thing of like, oh, I would hire more women musicians if I knew where to find them. And so Maestro was like, here, this is where you find them. And you can go in and like filter it by, I need a, you know, French horn player. I need a music director in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, like there are just different ways. It's like, if you're looking to diversify your room, Maestra is there. And in the meantime, that they're providing mentorship programs and support. And it's really special. And I'm really proud to be a member.
Currently, a preview production of the Fitzgeralds of St. Paul is happening November 8th through the 24th at Irish Classical Theatre Company here in Buffalo, New York. The show will be directed by Danny Medford and stars Shannon O'Boyle and Jewel Wilson-Bridges. Can you tell us a little bit about the show? You wrote the music, lyrics, and book or story. Where did the inspiration come from?
Totally. So I've been working on the show for 10 years, and the original idea for me came from a piece on NPR, a random piece from on NPR. A woman named Maureen Corrigan, who is one of the book critics for Fresh Air on NPR, wrote a book about the history of the Great Gatsby and about how it became the important piece of American literature that it is, because in F. Scott Fitzgerald's lifetime, it wasn't. It went out of print. And what happened was, during World War II, the publishing houses sent some of their lesser selling titles off with soldiers to war in these sort of like weird special editions that fit in their pockets. And so The Great Gatsby was one of the books that they're like, whatever, this is sitting around, we're going to send this with them. So all of these soldiers came back from World War II and were like, where has this book been? This book is incredible. But by that point, Scott Fitzgerald had been dead for 5 years. He died of a heart attack at the age of 44 in 1940. Thinking that he was a failure. And so Maureen Corrigan read this letter in this piece on Fresh Air talking about it from Scott Fitzgerald to his editor a few months before he died, asking basically to borrow money and asking if they would consider putting Gatsby back in print, and talking about how, you know, he really thought that it was a great book and really thought that it could find an audience. And, you know, that I think the exact quote was something like, you know, in some small way, I hope I'm remembered as an original. And so my brother had called me. I was going through a phase out of grad school where I was trying to stay afloat in New York City. I was working an overnight desk job, and just I was about to move home. I'm originally from Louisville, Kentucky. And I was just like about to just throw in a towel. I was just like, nobody cares what I'm doing. I can't, there's no way, you know, like I can barely afford to stay afloat here. I'm working overnight. Everything is terrible. And my brother called and was like, I want you to listen to this piece. I think it's going to speak to you. And The Great Gatsby is my favorite novel of all time. So to hear that during the writer's lifetime, it, you know, almost vanished into obscurity, and that he knew deep down that it would have an impact, and he didn't get to live to see that impact, really moved me. And so from there, I started reading more about him, because I realized, I was like, this is my favorite book. I don't know anything about the author. I need to learn more about him. And so in reading more about him, I started reading more about Zelda. And suddenly I was off to the races. And I just, as an experiment, I got asked to bring some songs to like a songwriter's night at a bar in the East Village. And I was like, I'm going to write a song for him, a song for her, and a song for both of them, and just see what it is. And I like put these songs up at this event. And before the performance, I said to the audience, you don't know if there's anything here, you know, let me know what you think. And like those three songs, which are still in the show, were the best received thing that I'd ever written in my life. Like people came up to me, like every single person in the audience came up to me and said, you have to write this show. And so from there I did. And it's been such a gratifying experience. You know, their story is so rich and so complicated. They were such deeply flawed, beautiful, infuriating people. And they brought out the best and the worst in each other. And it's given me the opportunity to explore themes of mental illness and gender politics and relationships and, you know, plagiarism. He plagiarized from her. And so like professional jealousy and just so addiction. There's so many layers to their story. And I'd never seen it told in the way that I was feeling about them. And so, you know, their story has been told by a lot of people and will continue to be told by people. I hope. I don't want to be the only person talking about them, you know. I welcome that. But I felt like I had some sort of insight into the inner bubble of their relationship, because the show is also just the two of them. It's a two-actor show. And that's what I was most interested in, was like the rare alchemy of their relationship and what the inside of that bubble looked like, and what it looked like when things from the outside threatened that bubble, whether it's, you know, their child or his mother or Ernest Hemingway, like, you know, or success or failure, like, or, you know, what does it look like, you know, inside of any relationship, you know? So, that was my jumping off point anyway.
How has the project shifted and changed over time? It's 10 years is a long time to be living with a project.
Yeah, that's a long time. And what's funny is when I started it, my thought was like, oh, this is going to have a short gestation period. It's imminently producible. It's two actors. It's a small band, you know, whatever. But part of it is just musicals are hard, long, exhausting work. And, you know, there's a limited number of opportunities. And, you know, sometimes, you know, in all art forms, you know, like the trends on the wind are not in your favor. And, you know, theaters were like, it's too small. I've had a few theaters say it's too big, at which point I'm like, are you okay? But the main thing is just that because we've gotten the luxury of a pretty extensive development process, we've really gotten to do a lot of work on the show. We've gotten to do a lot of table work. We've gotten to do a lot of discussions around character. And, you know, the show is very kind of abstract. It exists in a sort of liminal space. It's a memory play. And so, you know, we've gotten to like spend a lot of time talking about what that means and what that looks like and how to make that work in a way that makes sense to an audience. And we're still learning about it, you know, that this is the first time that we've ever staged it. So, you know, if I learned anything in grad school, it's that what you read on a page is not what you hear, and what you hear is not what you see. And until you've put a piece of theater through every single one of those paces, you don't fully know what you have. So, you know, I at this point have a really good understanding of what this looks like, you know, with actors standing behind music stands. But now I'm getting to learn, like, oh, when they're moving around, when there are costumes, when there's light, when, you know, they're in a real space, it's a totally different animal. So it's a little nerve-wracking, but also thrilling. And one of the great things about being at Irish Classical in particular is they have given us the space to play, and they've been really supportive and they're so excited about the show. And it, honestly, it's been a dream to work with them, because they gave us that space to experiment, and they want us to bring to Buffalo, you know, the show that we want to make. And that means the world to me.
Why is a preview production an Irish Classical Theater Company special for Buffalo audiences? Like, if someone's hearing this and think, oh, okay, maybe I'll go, like, why is it so special for them to see this production of the Fitzgeralds of St. Paul?
So we are working towards an off-Broadway production in 2026. I'm working with a producer and production company, and this is one piece in a strategy towards the show having a commercial run in New York. And, you know, back in the day, in, you know, the 50s and 60s, that's what musicals did. They would go out of New York to Boston or to New Haven or to Chicago or wherever, and try out and take the space to see how an audience responds and make adjustments. And this in our way is getting to have that old school experience, which is, from a creator standpoint, luxurious. Because part of the problem with theater nowadays is, like, you're not, because it is such an expensive and risky venture, particularly in New York at the professional level, you're not given the space to fail. You're not given the space to, like, get messy and learn what you have. And so the thing that I think is really unique about this opportunity for Buffalo audiences is to get a glimpse into the process and the making of a thing that will, knock on wood or whatever this countertop is made of, go on to be a hopefully a bigger thing. You know, get to peer into the process. Now, that's not to say that the thing that audiences are going to see in Buffalo is not going to be polished or, you know, a fully realized show. It will be. That is our hope. But, you know, it is, at the same time, you know, the sort of thing that, like, under normal circumstances would only be seen by a New York audience in previews. So I think getting to spend this time with Buffalo audiences is really unusual and really special.
I always like to ask this question because I think it's so interesting. What do you hope audience members discuss on the way home in the car after seeing the Fitzgeralds of St. Paul? Like, if you could be a fly on the wall, what would be the sort of ideal conversation?
Gosh, well, there are a few things. I hope that it makes them, first of all, want to learn more about these two people, particularly her. The show is really from her perspective. But also, the show takes place basically in Zelda Fitzgerald's mind as she's trying to sort of reconstruct her memory. And, you know, she's in a mental hospital, you know, her husband has died. She's trying to make sense of her life, basically. And, you know, a thing that I have found myself saying a lot, particularly around this show, is, in my experience, time is linear, but life isn't. And, you know, in looking back on our memories, things kind of loop back on themselves. And, you know, sometimes we get stuck in those loops. Sometimes, you know, we are not kind to ourselves. And so I think if there's a deeper thing that I want people to walk away from this with, it is being kinder to yourself when you look back and tell yourself the story of your life. Because, you know, we all are doing our best. We're all, you know, we're all human, and we're all having huge, complicated experiences. And so, yeah, I really hope that it helps people, you know, be more compassionate towards themselves, and, you know, be unafraid to have conversations about addiction and mental health and, you know, being a better partner, a better friend, a better collaborator, all of those things.
We can cut this if you don't want to answer it, but I also want to know, is there a song in the show that you hope that they're humming on the way home in the car?
All of them. For me as a writer, when I catch people like humming or singing along, that it thrills me. Like, I, you know, in our rehearsal process, like in the last week or so, I've caught the stage manager singing along, and I'm like, yes. So all of them. The great thing is, when we open on November 8th, we're also launching a Kickstarter to make an album with a bunch of Broadway people. We're making an old school concept album with different singers on each track. We've got a lot of really cool Santino Fontana and Grace McLean and Alicia Umfriss and Heidi Blickenstaff and all of these really cool Broadway singers. Lots more. I mean, I think they're going to be 21 in total. As well as our singers from the production, Shannon O'Boyle and Jewel Wilson Bridges will be on the album as well. So I'm hoping if people are excited about it, they're like, yay, I want an album now. So, you know, we'll see.
Fantastic. Chrissy, yeah. Those are my questions, but I always like to end an interview by asking, is there anything that you feel left unsaid or anything you'd like to share with our audiences before we say goodbye?
I'm just really excited to be in Buffalo. I'm really excited to be in a place where Scott Fitzgerald lived. He was here for a couple of years in his childhood. So it's really special to me to bring this piece to a part of his history. And I just hope that Buffalo audiences enjoy it.
Thanks so much. That was my interview with Chrissy. I hope you will see the Fitzgeralds of St. Paul at Irish Classical Theatre Company, November 8th through the 24th, 2024. Tickets are available at irishclassical.com. This episode was produced by Jessica Marinelli. Sarah Potter engineered this episode. In addition to this podcast, you can check out our local event guides posted bi-monthly on buffalorising.com. Make sure you subscribe to the show. If you like the show, please recommend it to a friend. Thanks for listening to Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studios.